I think right now, what if we were to reframe the way that we're thinking about teaching and learning in this moment? Like, we're in a global pandemic. This is a state of emergency that we're in. So then that fundamentally shifts everything mm-hmm. that we do and why we do it, right? Yeah. It requires a different set of skills to be able to kind of have empathy, but to also like be critical, self-critical, to do some work that I don't know that all teachers have the tools for right now, because right. our districts and our education system has done such a horrible job in preparing teachers for this moment. Mm-hmm. And in general, I think we're starting to realize that the way we've done school was never like accessible. It was never like, you know, it was never meant for our most vulnerable communities. And we see right. it now because of how they're not able to access these things.
Welcome to another episode of the Totos Math for All podcast. Okay, so we're now something like 8 weeks into our current, well, in California, I guess we'd call them shelter in place orders. You have this ongoing global health crisis that's surrounding COVID-19, and it's taking its toll on all of us. As a nation, various media outlets are reporting not only on the medical risks, but also on the shifting state of our mental health. Even though we might start to be feeling like we're adjusting to some new reality, as a nation, we're sleeping less, we are online more, we are exercising less, we are drinking more, we are working longer hours somehow, while also taking care of our children or our elderly parents, our families, our communities, and hopefully taking care of ourselves. For many families, the school is a community center and access to any resources that families might otherwise go without. Schools are more than academic spaces. In fact, even in this time, as many of you are probably experiencing, the school district has become a really rallying space to make sure that all students are fed, all students have access to the devices they need for online learning, etc. And while there's issues going on there, we also know that teachers are out there doing the work that they always do. Teachers are care workers, they're organizers, they're bridges between worlds, and they are hurting really hard right now. So anyway, whether you found yourself productive or not productive, whether you feel like you are surviving or thriving, or you feel like laughing or crying, this episode is all about how we continue to care for ourselves and each other while we face uncertainty. I asked Assistant Professor of Education, longtime teacher, educator, and organizer, Farima Pour-Khorshid, to talk with us about her research into teachers of color critical self-care.
So my name is Farima Pour-Khorshid, and I am a recent PhD. I graduated from UC Santa Cruz in 2018. I'm now a professor at the University of San Francisco. I work with teachers. I'm also a teacher supervisor, and I'm an organizer. So I'm a core organizer for the Teachers for Social Justice in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I'm also a board member for the Education for Liberation Network that puts on the Free Minds, Free People Conference. I am a lead facilitator with Flourish Agenda, which we do a lot of radical healing work in the community and beyond. And I'm also an organizer for the People's Education Movement in the Bay Area as well.
So just as an aside, she's not a healthcare professional, but she does have a doctorate in education. And in addition to being an East Bay neighbor, Farima also created one of the first resources that I thought was very compelling to both engage us critically with this moment and also give us guidance for how to take care, well, really to take care of ourselves in this moment. So in addition to talking about the resources that Farima has pulled together, which we have linked here from our podcast episode, we also talked about trying to understand the moment that we're in and what we need to be thinking about in this moment and what it means to be thinking about the collective and the community, even in the midst of a lot of, you know, need to take care of ourselves and focus on ourselves. We had a really nice conversation about this kind of push and pull between the individual and the collective. And I think if I'm remembering this first part of our conversation correctly, I was talking about feeling like I'm hearing too much messaging in the media around self-care being about taking care of oneself individually. And I brought that issue up with Farima to start our conversation. Anyway, without further ado, here is my conversation with Farima.
We don't Dr. see Farima the luxury or don't get the luxury in just thinking right. about ourselves. So we're like, yeah. what are you talking about, man?
Yeah.
Parents, just well, in case we are going to be using some adult language. Right?
Because I do think that even the ways that folks of color, like do the self-care piece, mm-hmm. that self-care piece is collective care, because if I'm well and taking care of myself and making sure that like I am able to show up for myself, mm-hmm. then I can show up for community in a different right. type of way. And that's why like I've been around so many folks who are in community and are always harming folks because they're not taking care of themselves. They're not mm-hmm. doing the necessary internal reflective work necessary to know how to show up for community. And so that self-care piece of like, when we are doing that individual work, if we have the orientation of like this individual work is about the collective, it's different mm-hmm. as opposed to like me just doing it to feel good for the sake of feeling good. Not to say that we shouldn't feel good because we deserve that and more, right? It's our human right. White folks do it all the time. But there's something about like our own fear of kind of falling into capitalist ways of taking care of ourselves that mm-hmm. keep us from really like taking care of ourselves, you know?
Right.
So that's real. Yeah, and you had asked the question just around like what educators can be doing right now to like care for themselves, but then also, you know, advocate for our most vulnerable families. And I sat with that question for a while as I think about my own positionality right now. You know, I am privileged as fuck, right? Because I'm able to work from home. I have a full-time salary. I'm a professor now, right? And so there's a lot of privileges that come with that. But I'm also caring for elderly folks with health issues. I'm also in a shared house with my uncle who works at the post office and is dealing with a lot of stress around that, right? My sister's a registered nurse and she's in a hospital with several confirmed cases. And so there's ways that we have to take care of each other, social distancing within a home that we all grew up in, right? Like there's all these pieces. And then of course her children, like I'm helping with her children, right? And so there's layers to it. And if we don't begin to think about people's circumstances differently as opposed to these blanketed ways of how we're talking about things, it becomes really dangerous, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think like one of the things that I did as a professor with my own students when all this happened was the first thing I did was I created a Google form to reach out to every single student and ask like, you know, how can I support you right now? Like, is there any essential needs that you have that I can help to find services for? What are some, you know, things that feel unsettling about this transition and what might help to make this transition more accommodating for you? Mm-hmm. Asking those questions individually to your families and to your students is like so important. Right. And if there's ways that your families and students can't access that form, then this is where we have to differentiate our shit and like make some phone calls,
right?
Show up if we need to. But I also say that reluctantly because when I say this from a brown body, from a brown body, from a working class background. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that scares me right now is that, as you know, the teaching profession is predominantly white. We're still at 83% white teachers. Uh-huh. There's something that feels really dangerous about white teachers having access to student homes in a way that they haven't before, right. Especially if they have not done the work to understand their own whiteness and white fragility and white gaze and just our internal biases. That worries the hell out of me because once they have access to students' homes in these ways, there's assumptions that are made. And then this is where we are quick. Let me not say we, but this is where some teachers are quick to call services, social services, child protective services. And those things can be so harmful for families that are already vulnerable.
Although it also sounds like in relation to that, have you been hearing the news about like the decrease in phone calls of what's going on in domestic violence or, you know, like shelters have had a drop in calls and things. And I'm wondering how to square the two of those, both that the danger of kind of a different kind of access to homes, but also
the danger of
not having mandatory reporters able to kind of do their job. And I don't know if there's like an easy answer, because I know the damage you're talking about in terms of once you start a process, you know, like that is not something you can stop doing to that family. So how do we kind
this
of
is what that, I mean. You know? Yeah. This is what I mean. And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because this is what I mean when we're talking about self and collective care is like, mm-hmm. how are you reflecting about these things? Like when you decide to make a decision to report or not report, to engage via technology or show up, right? Like mm-hmm. all of these things require a lot of reflection, and
right.
we shouldn't be reactionary. We should be really, really mindful, and we should have community pods. And I use that term. It's actually a term from the Bay Area, Transformative Justice Collective, but these pods of like, who are my people that I can call on and talk mm-hmm. things out with? Who are the organizations that I can go to get support on these issues? What are the resources? And like, you know, we talked about before I created that Google Doc of resources. That was part of my efforts of, you know, offering access for pod mapping, right? And that pod mapping piece is so, so important, because when crisis does happen, you have something to refer to or people to go to, and things to kind of get that additional support from, as opposed to trying mm-hmm. to do things on your own, which can be dangerous, you know?
Right.
So I think that's one piece.
Yeah. The support, like the having those systems in place. And what you said about teachers is also really interesting to me, because we both have a background in elementary teaching. And so I think that maybe this has been similar to your experience or not, but elementary teachers' relationships with families is very different than middle school, high school relationships. And I know, for example, that like it's harder, it can seem harder to make it your own job to personally reach out to families when you're a high school teacher, perhaps because you're like, of my 115 students, the kids who aren't showing up to first period right now are like the 20 students from newcomer families that maybe I've never established connection, you know? So I'm wondering like, oh man.
I feel you 100% on that. I actually, I feel so blessed to be in community with so many dope ass educators who are thinking about these things. And so my comrade from Hella and also from T4SJ, she's brilliant. Karen Zapata, we talked about this, and she talked about how like with her students, she created a three-tier system. And so she had to look at like top tier are the students who require the most support, services, attention in this moment right now. And these students can shift in tiers, right?
Right.
Middle is like, you know, they require some support, but they solid. They have a solid support system at home, you know? Mm-hmm. And then there's the bottom, which is like, they're good. You don't have to worry about it. It doesn't mean that you're not going to connect, but it right. gives you some focus on like who needs more access right now right. or care or attention. And then what does that look like? And once you have a targeted vision of how to think about support, mm-hmm. it gives you more opportunities to be creative on meeting everyone's needs. And so right. when I think about young people in particular, I think about, you know, I'm in the house with a high school student now. They have their homies, right? These mm-hmm. students have homies that they're checking in with, or, you know, they have their TikToks and social media. Like they're yes. engaging in different ways. So how do we adapt to where young people are to make sure that we're still able to make sure that they're okay? And so part of the things right. that I think about is like, what about creating buddy systems mm-hmm. within our course? Where it's like somebody in the buddy system is able to check in and let us know everything's cool, we're good, this is, you know, I'm okay, or right. squads. I like to call them healing-centered squads, mm-hmm. where you might have a group of four or five students that have a check-in every week, and maybe you can check in with them in that type of way, right, to make sure that they're okay. But I think the main goal is like, why are you contacting them? Like, what's uh-huh. the point? And if yeah. your point is to kind of take quota, right? Or to mark off. I mean, that's what I got from my niece. My niece was like, I just feel like some of my teachers are doing it because they need to do attendance and like, this is what's required. Mm-hmm. So I don't really care about checking in with them. But then there's other teachers who are checking in because they really do care about how we're experiencing this moment. And right. those are the ones that I want to be on. And so what's your intention behind communicating with your young folks? And that also helps to kind of have clarity on your method.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I know in my husband's case, like one of the things he told me is like it was very meaningful when a student who hadn't been able to come to class, when he did get a hold of that student or the student reached out, I can't remember which was, and the student was like, I'm working full time right now because I can and I'm working an essential job. And the student was like, can you just post your videos so I can watch them later? And he was like, yes, I can do it. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, I can do this for you. You can't make it to class. I can make it available. I'm not sure if the student is able to watch it, you know, we all have as educators ideas of what the best way to engage and learn math is or whatever. But he was able to be responsive to that because somehow they got in touch.
Right. You know? And checking in, it matters. Right. And then also like, I've been thinking a lot about, so I had this moment yesterday when I was with my niece and my nephew and my sister, and we were on our way to go do the run.
This is a reference to the run for Ahmaud Arbery.
In sixth grade. He's 11. And there's this moment where I paused and I was like, baby, how do you feel about like what we're getting ready to do and like what's happening, you know? And he was kind of like zoned out. He was like playing in his phone and he was like, I don't know, you know? And I said, well, just stop for a second. Like, let's just talk. Like, you know, what comes up for you as someone who's half black, you know, when you see a black man murdered for like running? And I noticed that he has been so kind of disconnected from the world lately because he's hasn't had to like, you know, really engage in those ways, that there was a sense of numbing that was happening there of detachment and dissociation. Right. So for me, it was really important in that moment as his auntie to like stop and pause and like process. And I told him like very emotionally, I said, you know, baby, I don't want you to become numb to this, because what's happening in our world right now is actually not normal. And it's actually okay for you to feel this right now, because I don't ever want you to think that this kind of racism is like, okay, it's not what should be happening. And this is like our ancestors fought so many, you know, and just having intentional conversations to process what's happening in our world, to me, is so much more important than trying to deliver content in this moment. The content is gonna come, you know, it will. It's sometimes we forget that learning happens all the time beyond, you know, the delivery of our, we're so egocentric sometimes, you know, as educators of like, if I don't deliver it, then they won't, you know,
sure, learn. You say that, Freema, but if I don't deliver the math, they're not gonna learn the math. I mean, like, that's what I hear. I'm totally joking.
I mean, but it's real, right? I mean, you know, it's how do we pause as we think about what
and also, you know, on that note also, like, since most of our audience is math teachers or people who work with math teachers, how do we pause in ways that let us like really trust that it will be okay? Because I think often, you know, high school, middle school math teacher, you're working with this urgency around material. And so it's hard to stop and say, like, I'm doing my kids just as good of a service if we don't get into linear equations before the school year is over or something. I don't know. So I wonder, so the question I keep hearing is the balance, which is a word that I think is very hard to work with right now. But have we transitioned yet into a we're done putting out the fires moment and we can kind of start to think, you know, like, what learning math will be like, or do we still need to be thinking? I mean, are we still in a time where it's like content versus something, like versus emotional support or versus wellness, or can we start to be thinking of those things together?
I think that's a really good question. And I think that it really, again, it's like understanding that fires look differently in different homes. You know what I mean? Like some folks are, their shit is burning up. And so your math equations don't mean shit to somebody who doesn't have food, who doesn't have, isn't able to access electricity or Wi-Fi, right? Like it's meaningless for them versus someone who's well-resourced and actually has the capacity and the tools and the resources to be able to access that and needs it because they need to focus on something and be occupied at home, right? And so I think even just that question requires us to take a pause to figure out like who's in my class and what's happening and then what does it look like to support them in this moment because everyone's needs are so different. And that's a big tall ass order for us as we're figuring out our own needs. Like how often are we pausing as educators, family members, partners to really give ourselves the space? It's hard to create the space for young people if we don't even create it for ourselves to figure out like where we're at and what we need. You know, and so it's huge. That's huge. We're first responders right now. And for some of us, it may not feel like that because of the zip codes that we teach in. And for others, we're drowning.
And it's really interesting to me also to think like, okay, so how many content specific teachers prior to our this current moment really thought of themselves as people who should be reaching very, you know, straight to the home to like talk to people and check on them. And I think there's a feeling for some teachers like, oh, they're dealing with their stuff. It's totally fine. They're not coming to school. But at the same time, that's the assumption, not the confirmation. And I kind of wonder about that too. Like my default is to like, you reach out and if they choose not to respond, maybe reach out one more time. But like, you know,
it's true. Cause we're also dealing with like a history of like low academic standards and expectations of young people of color in particular. So I hella get that 100%. And when you said like reaching out, it made me immediately think of one of my teacher homie comrades, Lisa Kelly. She came out with a piece called, you know, we shouldn't be calling it distance teaching or learning. We should be calling it reaching. And so she uses the acronym REACH. It stands for Remote Emergency Education for Community Health.
That's awesome. Who's this again?
And so this is Lisa Kelly. She is a middle school teacher in Oakland. And I thought that was brilliant because I think right now, what if we were to refrain or reframe the way that we're thinking about teaching and learning in this moment? Like we're in a global pandemic. This is a state of emergency that we're in. So then that fundamentally shifts everything that we do and why we do it, right? It requires a different set of skills. To be able to kind of have empathy, but to also like be critical, self-critical, to do some work that I don't know that all teachers have the tools for right now, because our districts and our education system has done such a horrible job in preparing teachers for this moment. And in general, I think we're starting to realize that the way we've done school was never like accessible. It was never like, you know, it was never meant for our most vulnerable communities. And we see it now because of how they're not able to access these things.
You know? Yeah. And I guess, and then that narrative can go two ways, right? It can either go to, so we have a lot of work to do, or it can get co-opted by the right and become the excuse for eradicating a public school system.
For sure.
Which is what I'm terrified of coming out of this.
Definitely. And it's such a catch 22, right? Because it's like, on the one hand, why is the onus always placed on individual teachers? Like we are part of a system that has set us up for this moment. Like we're not the, you know what I mean? And so there's that piece, but then there's the other piece of like, actually, yeah, we all have responsibilities to make sure that we are doing our job in ways that are equitable, in ways that are really supporting the most vulnerable of our students, right? And so it's both and I think that's where we need to be sitting in right now. It's gonna continue to be a both and forever. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's no like going back. And we were having this conversation with some of the TOTUS group getting together because we're beginning to draft a position statement on some of the things going on right now. And one of the things we were talking about in that session was like, there's no post-COVID moment in the same way that there's no going back to normal. These things mean nothing, right? And we have to really try to figure out what we're talking to and about. And one of the things you were talking about makes me wonder, so when all this was happening and school districts are scrambling to be like, what should we do since we can't meet in person? New schedules came out, new asks came out on teachers and all these things. And I know that some of the teachers that I talk to are just like, what we're being asked to do right now is, it feels like justifying our paycheck versus actually being able to do what we need to do. And so I'm curious if you have suggestions, lessons, or know of resources for teachers to be able to kind of frame their need for time and space to do things and how they might get together and then talk to administration. I don't know, you know, like I have the luxury of not being in school system right now. So I have a lot of privilege to be able to say like, I have a faculty union and we're doing our thing, but like, what can teachers, you know, kind of do?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's such an important question. And I think like one of the things that comes up for me as like, as all of this was unfolding, cause you know, I'm also a teacher supervisor. And so I supervise mm-hmm. student teachers that are trying to figure this thing out with their cooperating teachers, which is a hot ass mess. Right. Mm-hmm. But what I will say is one of the things that was most disturbing was everyone's rush to just hurry up and put something out, as opposed mm-hmm. to saying, you know what, this is happening. We're going to just postpone. Like we're going to make our spring uh-huh. break go from 2 weeks to like four. Mm-hmm. Until we can come up with a solid and sound plan and space for educators to really come up with something that they feel good about, as opposed to throwing them in the fire like that. So I think first and foremost, doing these haphazard kind of like planning and under these kinds of stressful conditions is fucked up. Like we have teachers who have, you know, who are single parents with mm-hmm. babies who, you know, under circumstances where they can take their children to daycare and then work looks different than when you can't do that. Right. Yeah. And so those things matter too. And so one of the things that I have been thinking a lot about, you know, a lot of my work is around healing-centered engagement. And so when we think about healing-centered engagement, we're thinking about healing at the individual level, at the interpersonal level, at the institutional level. And so one of my questions is like, how are we thinking about policies at the institutional level? Mm-hmm. And as we think about these policies that we're putting out, especially right now in this moment, or the practices that we decide we're going to do with young people you know, online, or the values that we have about grading or not, like all of these policies, are they exacerbating harm or are they actually offering reparations? Are we thinking about reparations in the ways that we make these decisions and policies?
I don't think so.
And that's the question.
I haven't seen that, you know.
And these are the questions that we need to be asking. And I think that it requires us to pause, which they're not letting us do. And so part of me, I say this, and I want to also recognize and be sensitive to the fact, again, that I have privilege. I'm not in a district. I have, you know, all these layers, but we have to kind of collectivize around this. We have to, we can't afford not to. And part of the collectivizing is asking those questions. Are these policies creating more harm or are they providing reparations and possibilities for well-being? And then the other question is, who is at the decision-making table? Because our kids are the ones who are most impacted. So if we have no young people in the room to kind of give feedback around some of these issues, if we have no families that are in the room, if we don't have teachers who have children and no, like who is at the room at that table making these decisions and who needs to be, you know what I mean? Who's not there that needs to be, and how do we collectivize around that?
Yeah. You know? For example, like if we were to name some of these decisions, right? The big one I think of is who's setting the new schedule. Because that shit is crazy. When you take the schedule that my husband was given for his students and his schedule for teaching, schedule my son was given, because that teacher's trying to work around her kids' schedules and her husband's teaching schedule, and you have one school who's doing it from teachers do set your schedules, and another school that's like, okay, so that we don't have overlapping competing schedules, here's your schedule, including meetings, including new PLC times, including I don't know what else. And then so the schedule is a big one. I think also the expectation of what can students expect from teachers. I don't think there's been any discussion on. And I was talking to another colleague. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, on when you were saying that about schedules, the first thing I thought about is like, we've always had problems with our schedules. The fact that I had kindergartners that had to scarf down their lunch in 10 minutes and had, you know, less than 10 minutes to play, like the shit was never normal. And it's even worse now. And so it's challenging us to have to really think about these things. And not to say we haven't already been thinking about them, because like I said, folks at the margins are always thinking about this shit. You know what I mean? But it does give us an opportunity to really pause. Why are we reproducing a factory model of schooling in people's homes? It does not
yes,
work.
Yes, yes. This you is know, the question like, I had too for like, if we're going to go fully online for fall, why do we have to stick to the current time blocks, and why isn't the Senate having that discussion? Because I don't have to transition in the same way between classes, but also I don't want to teach a 3-hour online class, you right. know? So like, why can't right. we be rethinking these things? And the schedule that, you know, that I've seen some high school teachers working with 90-minute blocks seems to be working well for some students and not well for others. And, you know, and the teachers who are pre-recording stuff and not teaching at all, is that the way, are they kind of being held to the same standards as the teachers who are trying to hold partially synchronous things and other, you know what I mean? Like there's, it's yes. all over the place.
Yes. Cause we all also know that we've yeah. worked with colleagues who are the ones that don't do shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And never did do shit. And yet we're the ones working our ass off to be critical and social justice minded and creating all this bomb ass curriculum, mm-hmm. you know? And so that still exists. You know what I mean? Like yeah. that also still exists. And it's a real question. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's a real question.
Maybe we should try to get better stuff out on Teachers Pay Teachers then.
I mean, you know, the other thing I was thinking about too, let me tell you, I almost lost my shit because as I was trying to help my own loved ones navigate their elementary curriculum, mm-hmm. can you, like, we have educators right now that are trying so hard to put everything online, but they have them everywhere. You go to Google Classroom or you go to Google Docs or you go to, you know, all these different platforms. And it's yeah. overwhelming for young people and it's mm-hmm. overwhelming for their families. Right. You know what I mean? And for families who are not able to help their kids with some of the content and the homework, mm-hmm. can you imagine how frustrating it must feel for a young person to try to figure this out on their own because they literally don't have the support because their parents are trying to survive? And yeah. so many of our young people are also helping their younger siblings.
Yeah.
Or our young people are working. Right?
Yes,
or
exactly.
babysitting under the table. Like all these things play a role in what we expect of our students, you know? Mm-hmm. So and that's
there
real.
There has been almost no discussion of what students should expect from their teachers, from their school. I wish I knew yeah. what principals were. I know what my principals were saying to our school, but I wish I had a better sense of what principals are communicating to their families and mm-hmm. you know, what's going on and what they can expect. And I mean, hiring mm-hmm. for next year is also a whole other story, right? Like,
yeah,
so many of my students are doing their job interviews or interviewing online and accepting jobs without ever having like set foot in a school or.
And that's dangerous like, on a whole wow. other level.
Yeah.
It is
yeah.
It's scary. I know of some teacher ed programs who are literally suspending their programs because they just can't meet the clinical hours, right? And so that's another scary piece is like, if student teachers don't have the opportunity to be in and observe and practice in classrooms ahead of time,
right.
we're throwing them in the fire too. Not to say that doesn't already happen with things like TFA, you know,
right.
but that's not what we want. Like that's
well,
not-
now we're also throwing them into the online Google Classroom fire, which is very interesting. Like I keep mm-hmm. thinking like if this on and off, sometimes in person, sometimes distance is going to be a reality for the next few years, right? Which is very possible, then we right. have this very interesting, like, to learn to teach well, quote unquote, whatever well means, over the next few years, then you do have to kind of learn in both environments or something. That's, yeah, that's wild and new, you know?
Yeah. It makes me think of, like, two things. Like, one thing that it makes me think about is the fact that, like, you know, when I was in high school, and I feel hella old saying this, okay? But I'm saying, like, when I was in high school, I had a beeper, okay? I didn't have a text message.
I did too. You know?
And so my thing is, like, you know, the virtual world has revolutionized human engagement and interaction mm-hmm. on a whole yeah. different level. We have folks that can't even have difficult conversations face-to-face because we've learned how to kind of have that tech courage behind yeah. a screen, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's cyberbullying. There's like all these other issues that are happening already virtually mm-hmm. that we as schools have not done a good job at okay. like providing tools for young people to know how to navigate in healthy ways. So there's that piece. You got young people that are uploading shit that can criminalize them, that can mm-hmm. be used against them, right? When are we having these conversations as well? So that's like one piece. Then the other piece is we also have brilliant ass young people that have mastered this tech game more than any of our teachers have.
Right.
And so why is it that we think we're so damn smart and you know, we're so egocentric, like I said, that we're the ones imparting, when our young people have a lot to teach us about this tech world. And how are we offering that space for young people to do that? They're living it up on TikTok, making all kinds of tutorials and, you know, creating joy, right? And how are we bringing that into our instruction? You know?
Yeah, I would love to know more about that, because the older I get, the harder it is for me to figure out tech that doesn't match the tech I learned when I was in my 20s.
Right. Girl, we had AOL. You got mail.
I'm looking for like an enter button. I'm like, where's the, technology's coming out now are intuitive to people who like are integrated into technology. And, you know, a lot of my scholarship is around like math identity and like the identities that kind of intersect with our math identities. And just thinking that what it means to have an identity that's entangled and enmeshed with a consciousness that's constantly on the internet is, because I can remember a time before stuff like that, before instant feedback, I feel like I don't have a fully online identity, but like my sons are growing up with this sense of a world in their brain that has a space that's bigger than this. And that's fascinating. But at the same time, so in this meeting as in the other day, one of my colleagues is bringing up the concern she has around the commercialization of a lot of what's happening. She was thinking in particular of math classrooms where a lot of privately held technologies are making their way into the classroom, and they're going to be very well positioned to be like the platforms that school districts then turn to, you know, once we're post crisis and kind of more settled, and then we're going to all have to start paying for the free stuff that we've been trying out, you know. Zoom, it's really freaky how Zoom has become a verb and a noun and a,
you know. Yep, that's hella real.
We already accepted Googling, you know, Google's already part. And so she was bringing up these issues around like commercialization, where it feels like you can get around them. And if you're in a public school space, because at least when you're together, you can shut out, you know, kind of some of the private interest. But it doesn't, there's no public utility piece to being on the internet. So everything is corporate somehow.
And then there's a whole piece of like, what happens when you have these hackers that bomb your sessions and these like white supremacists and like, you know, it's like, there's all these layers to using technology that are just not being thought about more deeply. Right. Like, instead it's just like, well, now I'll just use a password. Actually, can we just stop and talk about like what the fuck this even means, and that people can hack into our stuff this way, and like the fact that they're so invested in you know, spewing racism in elementary classrooms and college classrooms. Like, let's pause and let's just unpack that.
Yeah.
You know, and so everything right now feels very reactionary. And that's why the last time we talked, when we were talking about, you know, the triggers and our trauma responses, we're being hit with shit constantly. And the ways that we're reacting to these triggers matters, right? And if we don't know how we're reacting, if we don't have some sort of tool to pause and to really be with ourselves and figure out like, damn, what's showing up for me right now? Do I find myself like feeling like I need to like dissociate and throw myself into work and like find out all these different like platforms and just produce? Because that's a trauma response, right?
Right. Yeah.
All of these things matter. And I think if anything, for any educator right now, I'll continue to kind of say like the tool that I use is that tracking system, mind, body, heart, on a scale of 1 to 10, where am I at? What do I need? How can I slow down and be present with what is right now? As opposed to just like, you know, cause I think all of us are at a place where we feel like we need to do something. And that sense of urgency and desperation is a beautiful thing in terms of solidarity, but it can also be a dangerous thing if we are reacting too quickly and doing it on our own and not really kind of coming together with other folks to think this through. And this is where I think the coalition building comes in. This is where I think it's so important, if you have not already been connected, which you should be in a field like education, we have to be part of collectives that are thinking this way, especially if we haven't been. So if you don't have the tools and haven't done that work, you got to find spaces where they're doing that work, not to co-opt, not to learn the language so that you're in, but to really get the tools to think through these things in the ways that our young folks deserve. And so those spaces can be Teachers for Social Justice. It could be the Education for Liberation Network. It could be the Radical STEM educators, right?
It could be TODOS. It could be the TODOS webinars and panels that we host.
All of
that will be coming this summer, right?
There you go. All of that shit matters. That is those are your tools. Those are your weapons. I guess I'm trying to get away from using the war and weapon kind of, those are your garden tools.
Right.
Plant and to harvest, right?
To cultivate. Like,
mm-hmm. To cultivate. And if you don't have that, then your shit is going to be full of weeds, you know?
Right. And I think also like for a lot of math teachers, well, I mean, a lot of people listening to our podcast are already very much like, yes, I need to, you know, like I have my communities and things. But I also think that it's important to say out loud and say again that like, you don't have to already be in a certain place with these ideas, right? Like for some people, maybe it's that our new crisis moment is the entry point, oh man, I need to really start thinking about some of these things more. And I think that can be very hard if you're seen as a content expert, mm-hmm. for two reasons. One is because often it's, you love your content, right? Mm-hmm. So it can be very hard to get out of that place of being like, well, what I really understand is stats and calculus and graphing, mm-hmm. And what are you talking about that I have to be thinking more carefully, collectively, and deeply about, you know, coalition building? And to that I say, like, really, that's take a risk.
Yeah.
Broaden your world. Like, go out and like and encourage your teaching team.
Yeah.
Say, like, let's start looking at some of these resources. Let's go to a TODOS webinar. Let's go to one of the NCTM webinars focused on equity, or let's just start somewhere and see.
Yeah.
See what we can learn right now, because you know we can all always learn more, right?
Yeah, because that's the thing, you know, ego is a hell of a drug, and mm-hmm. It will kill us, you know. And so the moment that you think that you don't need to keep learning, I don't trust you as an educator. I think that that is not the way that we should be thinking about this. And the same goes with healing, right? When we think about our own healing, when we think we've arrived, that to me is scary. You're not safe for me, because we're always in a, as long as you live in this society that is shaped by white supremacy, colonialism, you can't ever be at a place where you're just done. Right? Like you've arrived. And so how do we create a culture of humility? Because that mm-hmm. is medicine. Humility is medicine. Mm-hmm. And how do we, within that culture, actually develop practices and rituals with folks? So like, you know, using a webinar like this, all of us, you know, maybe a group of five of us will, you know, listen to it on our own. And now let's once a week or bi-weekly have an hour talk where we just kind of unpack some of these things and how we plan to apply it in our practice. Like those things matter. One of the things that the education system has done to us is that they deprofessionalized us, they deintellectualized mm-hmm. us. And so this is our chance and opportunity and really like obligation and responsibility to get that shit back. Like we have to take it back, you know?
And they try to keep us so busy
and silent.
We're too tired to build community and to build coalitions. And
exactly.
And to that I say, when you go on a walk, listen to a podcast. That's one step. Second, just start reaching out, right?
Yeah.
Follow your people. Yeah.
Just lay outside. I be on my recliner patio chair and I just lay down under mm-hmm. the sun and listen. If you have a yard, if you don't, what is your sacred space in your home where you can, you know, just be and to, you know, take a bath and listen to it as you're like,
right.
Whatever it is that you
under need. A blanket in your yeah. own bed, whatever exactly. it is. Yeah,
exactly. But that's the work. And I always say, you know, activism is healing. Social movement building is healing. This has been passed down to us from our ancestors. This is something that continues to run through our veins, including, you know, white folks, right? Like there were white folks who were anti-racist white folks in solidarity with folks of color. Like, how do we tap back into that lineage? What does that look like in this moment?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And how do we also like, how do we find out what our levels of discomfort are and lean into them in the name of learning and building relationships?
Yeah, be curious about it. No,
there's
judgment.
This really great concept from design learning, I think it is, from like the Stanford Design School, mm-hmm. where they have that like set of design for equity cards, which is so cool. The one I really love and I keep thinking about all the time is the failing fast idea, because I think it's really connected to not being afraid to try something and then being humble and listening to feedback, right? So that you can move on to something that works. And I think in the math ed world, we're often held back by fear of being misunderstood. So we have lots of ways of trying to either avoid conversations around race and racism or issues of social justice in the name of that's not really math, because we're really afraid of where that'll lead. Like, it'll lead too far away from learning math, or it'll lead to topics that are uncomfortable.
Or it can lead to
harming children. Yes.
Yeah, that's real.
This is a good concern, right? But trying to kind of find the area between I'm too afraid to try something and harming children. Like, we don't want to harm children, you know?
That's so important, because as educators, isn't that what we tell our students all the time? You learn from your mistakes. And so how do we start to really model that actively with integrity? Mm-hmm. Like, do we really learn from mistakes? Do we allow ourselves to learn from mistakes?
Yeah.
You know?
With integrity, and like you're all saying, like with humility, like, which can be very hard. If you have, would you say ego is a hell of a drug?
It really
is. That's a great line.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I think this moment really calls for us to like start doing that work. I think that's the beautiful thing about this, is that so many of us do feel lost. And what a beautiful thing to feel lost collectively, so that we can collectively start to find our way back. And so in those ways, I think that it's beautiful. It's a beautiful struggle. It's hard as fuck. It will continue to be challenging for all of us. But the one thing that we should not do is to become desensitized to what's happening to our young people just because we're not experiencing their same struggles firsthand. So that's what I challenge us to do, is to like, don't numb ourselves for the sake of productivity. Like, we have to continue to connect to our humanity and to the humanity of all of our young people and families right now. And if you're a teacher who is in, you know, an area that is, you know, affluent, use your privilege, leverage that privilege, figure out what can your families donate so that you can then resource other communities, other schools that don't have, like, you can still always do something. And so I really urge and challenge folks who do have some space and time, use that space and time, because there are folks that are on the front lines right now who are not sleeping. They are not eating. They are not stopping because they need support. And so what is your entry point to support others if you have the space, you know, and the capacity to do so?
Oh, that's wonderful. I think that's a beautiful ending note.
Lots of powerful food for thought in there. I'd like to thank our guest, Farima Pour-Khurshid, for joining us. The Todos podcast is a production of Todos Mathematics for All, and we feature the music of Vector Hold. Todos will also be hosting, in conjunction with NCTM, part of their 100 Days of Professional Learning. Look for information on our website, or coming out from NCTM as well, July 6th through 10th. Join us for our webinars focused on the mission of Todos in conjunction with NCTM's 100 Days of Professional Learning. In addition, just want to remind our listeners that Todos Live has been producing a variety of webinars on lots of different topics related to professional development and teaching mathematics. Topics especially relevant to equity and social justice, and during our current ongoing transitions to online teaching, and providing some direction in this time of uncertainty. Do check out our recorded Todos webinars as well at the Todos website, and information about upcoming webinars. You do not want to miss them. They are always way more fun to be at live, even though you can always watch our video later. Well, we hope everyone is staying safe during our ongoing pandemic. Hope you and your loved ones are well, and letting the Todos podcast keep you company. So until I see you next time, seguimos luchando y adiós.